are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Okay, Michael, welcome to the Serious Growth Podcast. I appreciate you coming on. You're a violinist, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Have you played the violin like the whole time, or how did you get into music? And was the violin your one and only, or how did that work for you?
I started when I was 9, and I haven't put it down since.
Is that right?
The guitar I picked up around high school and still play off and on, but mostly just violin.
Okay. When I was young, I was in probably, I can tell you, fifth grade, I started playing the tenor sax. My dad loved playing tenor sax, and I just, when I got into school, I was mainly an athlete, but, you know, he got me into music. And I have to tell you something. I really loved, it meant more to me once I was away from it, because as I got older in high school, I stopped playing because I couldn't. I was playing athletics at that point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I after being out of it, out of school and everything, I really appreciate the fact that I had that experience with music. And, you know, my kids didn't do that. And I kind of think in the back of my head, because they were big time athletes and they went on to play pro and that kind of thing. But, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, you know, I wonder if it would have made a difference to them getting into music, because it did for me, actually. You know, it's just something else to kind of expand your experience. Would you agree with that?
I would. It's an outlet, and you can always return to it. You never forget it, even though maybe months or years pass, you could still pick it up and it seemed familiar, part of it would.
Yeah, and I assume that you, at the age of 9, did you already start learning how to read music, or did you play by ear?
I went to a Catholic school and the nuns just immediately, they teach you rhythm along with the fingering on the fingerboard, so both.
Yeah.
At the same time, which is a European style.
Oh, okay.
You learned count and play at the same time.
Okay. Now, is the violin very much, because I learned how to play guitar by ear. I could read music with a saxophone, but I learned guitar by ear. Is the violin very much like a guitar as far as the chords and all that?
It's tuned in fifths, and we have 4 strings where guitars have 6.
That's right.
It's a different tuning.
Yeah.
Did I kind of answer that okay?
Yeah, I think you did. And the violin, man, is just really, I've heard some pieces done with the violin. It's beautiful, huh? It's fantastic.
You got Niccolo Paganini, and just, he blows everyone away.
What's his name?
Niccolo Paganini.
Paganini, I got to remember that, because I love violin.
Any fiddle player would know about it.
Yeah, did you have a
He would play in what they call flash. He had double stops, more than one string at a time. He'd make a chord. In that sense, he's like a guitar player. He could chord it, and he did magic. It was just, he scared people. No one's that good.
Is that right? Now, Paganini sounds like an Italian name. Am I right about that?
Very, yeah.
Okay, and I assume, what year, when did he play?
Well, I know his demise was in his death. His passing was in 1840, but I forget when he was born.
Okay, so he's way back then. He was one.
And he wrote all over Europe, and he wrote a lot. He's famous for his 24 caprices. They're solo violin pieces, show-off pieces, really.
Yeah.
But musical integrity, they weren't just flash. They had substance, and they're beautiful. And
yeah. Also
very difficult for me.
What sort of led you to the violin? Of all the instruments out there, what made you go to the violin?
I was sitting in a classroom when I was about 9, and one of the nuns, who's now a very dear friend of mine, she came in and she said, "We're starting up a little group. You want to consider playing the violin?" I looked up at her and I says, "I don't care." And she says, "Well, let's give it a try." So it started from there. She's very patient, very patient nun.
Yeah. I know that when I was doing the music with my music teacher, I mean, they gave us, how often did she make you practice during the week? Because we had to practice like X amount of times during the week. Was that the same with you?
Yeah, you can't practice enough. I mean, it's at that age, if the parents don't, you know, if they don't support, if they don't say, come on, Johnny, you know, you're supposed to do your scales now, you know,
yeah.
Get the TV and do your scales.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, pretty much regularly, the little bit better you get in myself personally, if something sounded like it grooved, it fell in place,
yeah,
that'd want me to practice more. So it's kind of a step-by-step thing.
Yeah.
Everyone evolves differently, but
yeah.
As a beginner, you know, the hard thing is to keep the students interested until they do start sounding like they're making headway.
Yeah.
And then the student can't wait to get it, can't play enough.
Yeah. It's like anything else. Once you get hooked on it, changes that.
Yeah.
Do you think that, you know, being creative like that with an instrument, do you think that sometimes that practicing, I know you're saying you can't do enough of that, but that doesn't mean that, do you think that if you practice too much at one time is less beneficial than less time and doing it more frequent?
Very good question. It depends on what you're practicing and what your age is and how long you practice. There's an old saying, you know, I'm sure you've heard it. Well, a good player will practice 8 hours a day. And then I heard someone else years ago say, if you can accomplish in 3 hours what normally would take eight, why exhaust yourself for five more hours?
Right.
Just if you got it done, as long as you got it done in three hours. But the thing, you know, it's an individual thing. And you can, at a young age, you can burn out because you're just so saturated with da-da-da-da-da-da-da back and forth. Later in life, you'll develop tendonitis, shoulder problems, like Heifetz had surgery, because it's just, the human body can take so much after
all. All right, let's take a quick break so I can tell you about our product.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you Big Beyond Belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
That's amazing. I would have never thought that playing a violin would cause somebody to have shoulder surgery, for goodness sake. Is it just because of the angle that it's at and it's got to be there for hours? Is that what it's overuse, obviously.
Yeah, I'm not qualified to answer that in the sense that everyone's individual. And what I might have, I used to have a shoulder problem myself. It appeared one morning and then about 8 months later, it disappeared with no rhyme or reason.
Yeah.
So each person that plays, and depends on soloists, got their work cut out because they're under the gun.
Yeah.
Got all this flash and perfection to, where when you sit in orchestra and playing section, you're playing your backup, so you're just playing whole notes and letting the soloists do all the damn work.
Yeah. So you can take a little time off in between while they're doing all the heavy lifting, right?
You don't let the conductor see you take the time.
Yeah. You got to be good at that. He wouldn't call you out in the middle of
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, they will.
Do they have their own secret ways of doing that? Like, you know, like he's going to pull his belt out and beat the shit out of you or something?
Well, there's that possibility. up in the Bay Area is in a famous youth chamber orchestra under Bob Hughes. And what he would do, I haven't seen that done down in Los Angeles, but at least in the Bay Area, he'd say, okay, third desk. A desk meaning two players per music stand or a desk. Uh-huh. So we got a stand partner. One guy turns the pages as he plays, and the other one just plays.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that.
Bob would call us out if he didn't like what he would test us in front of the whole group, say, okay, third music stand, inside player, start at letter B.
Ooh.
Letter C, and you better play right.
Ooh.
Of course, everyone's nervous, so you know the bow's going to shake a little bit.
You're human.
Being human, you know.
Well, you know something. When you have would you call him a conductor?
Yeah. Maestro, okay. Conductor.
Maestro. When you have somebody like that you know could call on you, all he has to do is do that one time. And for me, that would be forever in my mind. You know, it's like he's like the conductor terrorist up there that I know that if I screw up, he just could, and I'm not willing to take that chance, right?
Am I in the gun sights now?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know that.
I learned it with conductors. They like to be looked at because they want to know that everyone's following them.
Yeah.
Not too much eye contact when it comes to players and directors.
Yeah, I would think that if I was a conductor, and especially if I love the power, I wouldn't want you to disrespect me like that.
Yeah, no. It's like a captain and a soldiers. You want everyone on the same
boat. Sure,
And that's all they're there for, because a lot of the players don't need a conductor. We can feel the pulse.
Yeah.
A good concertmaster can lead the section and has.
Yeah.
The conductor is needed for inspiration and phrasing and cueing.
Yeah.
So it's an important job to be.
Oh, yeah.
And I would that goes along with it.
Yeah. And I would imagine that, you know, any good coach, great coach, they know when to press and when to back off. You know, I would think the same thing would be with a maestro. You know, he has to do this in a way that is seamless, but yet he's getting stuff done and making it all come together. That's just my guess.
Exactly, Leo. He wants to, you know, encourage whatever it takes.
Yeah.
My Toscanini, famous story. I had a friend of mine, fiddle player, gave me a cassette, someone back east in New York, I think it was, tape recorded a rehearsal for the NBC Orchestra. And he's screaming at the orchestra in Italian, so I don't know what he was saying. It was starting the whole orchestra, and these are some of the top players in the universe,
yeah.
You know, and they can play.
Yeah.
And they would start, they'd get about a measure and a half, and he'd stop the orchestra screaming again and have them start at the top. They did this about five or six times. I'm going, that's just two or three measures into the very beginning of the piece. So, I mean, each conductor, they're temperamental, but they're also gifted. Yeah. So you got to show respect where it's due.
Yeah. Is that kind of across the board, the people that are maestros? Like, are they all kind of temperamental because they're so creative? And
no, some you have are just crack jokes up a lot, and some are very easygoing. Some are, you know, you don't hear a peep out of them. They just get up and, you know.
Yeah.
So everyone's different individual.
A little bit different that way. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, now, because of the pandemic, all the orchestras are kind of shut down, at least in LA County that I'm aware of, because of closure. Because it's, sure. How do you get 80 musicians on a stage 6 feet difference?
Yeah, you can't do that.
I mean, stages aren't that big. I mean,
right.
Scoring sound stage could be, but no.
I was going to ask you if there were any... if they're playing like any events or concerts like that because of what's going on. You just answered my question.
I think they could possibly do it one-on-one or maybe a small group in a living room on Zoom.
Yeah, but as far as going to like any kind of an event or a theater, they're not doing that at all?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they did it on someone's front lawn, because there they have room. They can distance it, be outside and just bring the people to the concert.
Yeah.
They're not allowed in the auditorium. So I think quite a bit of that may be going on. People with backyards or front yards.
Yeah.
String quartets, there's plenty of room to
move. Yeah, yeah. And so how many?
They're wearing the mask, so no one's here.
Yeah, yeah. How many years have you been actually, you started at 9. You don't have to reveal your age, but how many years have you been playing?
Yeah, well, I just turned 70. So whatever the
Man.
I flunked math. So what is that?
It's a lot. Let's just say it that way. It's a lot. It's a lot of darn time, you know. And it sounds like you still love it like you did
before. Yeah.
You know, you and I are lucky people, because you know I'm in the fitness and bodybuilding industry. You know, and it happens to be my passion now for 38 years. I'm not at your level of mastery, but I've been 38 years every single day. This is my livelihood and it's my passion. I wake up every morning to go to it, you know, willingly. My wife even says, why are you still doing this? I said, well, I love it. And why should I quit? That doesn't make any damn sense. Do you feel that way?
I think it's perfectly normal.
I think we're so darn lucky.
You get it in your blood, and how do you get it out?
You can't. You can't. I've tried. I've tried taking time off, and, you know, I'm way worse to live with when I do that, you know? So the between those two options, you know, mm-hmm. I get a pass on that. But I would get one anyway because I have to do it. It's just part of what I do. It's part of who I am.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes a big, you know, when you can start making a living on it, which you did, it just changes the whole ball game, doesn't it? Instead of just going to a job.
Exactly. You almost feel like if you've been like, there'll be times when I haven't picked up the fiddle in 6-7 days, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm staring at a look at the violin case and turn my head back and get the gilts. I'll be with you in a minute, honey. Just give me an hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. It doesn't feel natural when we kind of avoid it.
That is true.
Kind of denied it.
That is so true. And you know, unless you're that person that has the kind of passion and what it means to us, you don't. Sometimes you just don't get that. It's like, this seems so extreme. I've heard this before with me. It's so extreme, and you know, why would you want to keep doing this like this? You know, because waitering, of course, at the level that I was at. It's not, if you're having fun in the gym, you're not really working out. I mean, it's not fun. It's a love-hate relationship. Is it like that when you're playing an instrument, or is it just pure fun, pure enjoyment?
It's pure enjoyment when you accomplish something that you had it was like a hurdle to get over.
Right.
Me personally, you know, there's certain things I'm not qualified. I'm just not that gifted to do certain things at certain meter, you know, time.
Yeah.
Fast or slow. But it's a sense, you know, when something feels right, you know, instinct, you know, when you've accomplished some athletics and you say, damn.
Yeah, exactly.
Musicians, I think when they know that they know it's, oh boy, here comes that steep mountain. We got to climb again.
Yeah.
And then the plateau, we're going to cruise down the other side.
Yeah. Interesting. Hey, do you write your own music?
Yeah.
You do?
Okay.
And have you had any of your music published?
Not published, but performed.
So you perform your own music? Oh, do other people perform your music?
Yeah. There's a group out in Las Vegas called Rodolfo Fernandez is a conductor and maestro. He's from Bolivia. And they did about 5 premieres over the years at the Clark County Library. They have a little stage inside the library in Las Vegas. Not a show stage for really, because casinos aren't. But so it was an all string group, trust fund, so it was Union Orchestra, and so they did it, and they're all original things. I wrote it one piece for a cat that I ended up adopting from a neighbor moved up to Santa Maria, and another one I had a cockatiel, a bird, and one called Harry the Bird, and the orchestra was fantastic. It's nice to hear something you create.
Yeah.
You're sitting out in the audience. You're not sitting there playing it because your mind would be, I hope they play this section right.
Yeah.
And so by thinking that, I'd be making my own mistakes as I'm playing. So it's better for the composers to just sit back and let them play, and then you listen and take notes.
Let me ask you
that. To answer that, yes.
Yeah, when you're listening to something that you've written and you have other people performing what you've written, are you highly critical? Are you like, for example, like when I did a lot of photo shoots because of the industry I was in. That's just part of what we did. And I got to tell you, most of the photos that were taken, I didn't like. But there were those that I really, really liked. Mm-hmm. So when somebody else is playing your music, are you pretty critical? And does that change? You know, sometimes in the beginning, like when I was looking at photos, the ones that I really didn't like end up being some of my favorite ones because when I was first looking at them, I was too close to them. I was too subjective, I guess.
Yeah.
And those photos became more objective. Does that happen in music, like when you're on the other side of that?
You self-analyze. You're going, what possessed me to write that lick?
Yeah.
You know, or you go, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to hear.
Yeah.
So you critique yourself more, I think, than the performance.
Right.
Especially on a first read-through.
When you
see the music the first time, they're just hacking through it. And so you take notes like everyone, you know.
Yeah.
I consider myself an amateur writer, but I you know, I can, I've had people like it.
Yeah.
But so to, that's a good question to answer. It's a lot of things go through your mind. You're hearing it. You hear it in your head, and now you're hearing it live.
Right.
And so it, it, it takes on its own animal.
Yeah. So sometimes it sounds like kind of what I was explaining to you, that you end up liking some of the ones that maybe you didn't quite like in the beginning. They turn something. Yeah, interesting. When you're writing music, I wrote a book, and I learned a lot from a book that I wrote. And I learned what writer's block meant, and it was very frustrating to me because the more I tried when I was blocked, the worse it got. And so it was counterintuitive for me to put the damn thing away and to come back to it. And that's exactly what I needed. When you're composing music like that, are there times where, there were times when I was writing, it was almost like, because I was doing it with a pen at that time, not a computer, but it was almost like the pen was, I was just following the pen. It was just, everything was flowing and I couldn't like keep up with it. Is that something that happens to you when you're writing music?
When you get a certain, you know how things pop, Leo? They pop all at once.
Yeah.
And so your pen was going.
Yeah, I was just following it. I was trying to hang on to it.
Follow like a magnet.
Yeah.
And some people can argue with that, but I don't know. It worked for me in a lot of, sometimes that block is there and go, wait, why am I writing that lick? I mean, it's too hokey. It's lame.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so yeah, you got to be self-critical, but when you've got that flow going, trust it.
It's scary, huh? And that's with a lot of people, and same with training. You have to learn how to be instinctive and trust your instincts. And I think that what happens a lot of times, this is my own theory and opinion. I think that what happens to a lot of people, and I think it has to do with, you know, our parents that raise us and maybe the schools that we go to. But I think that we, the people that are teaching us sometimes, teach us not to trust our instinct. And when you start doing that, at first it was for me, it was scary because it was almost counterintuitive in a way. Mm-hmm. And what I did learn was when I did trust my instinct, you know, and it worked out, it's like, oh, so this is what it's like, you know. But do you find that like that in music too?
Yeah, if you have a good idea, Leo, you know, go with it, and you can always come back later and fine tune it.
Good point.
Because you can't. It's, you know, this, it's still a free world, we hope.
Yeah.
So, you know, go with the flow. And if you're feeling up to it, call on some close friends and say, what do you think about, get some outside opinions maybe.
Yeah.
And you can always retune it. But a lot of people, I heard about that term writer's block. Apparently it's paramount.
It's awful. It's just really awful. I mean, I had a block for 3 months. I couldn't write anything.
I was just going to ask you how long they could last.
3 months. I'm thinking, how in the hell, I was kind of freaking out. Then it gets to your head, you know, you start, was this it? Is this the book? Am I dead in the water now? Do I not have a book? You know, because there was more, I just couldn't, for the life of me. I guess that was maybe the same thing as, you know, in weight training, we have a, I don't know if you want to call it phenomenon, but physiologically, sometimes you do too much and you overtrain all the sensories in your body. You know, physiologically, mentally, emotionally, and your body, it just shuts you down to protect you, actually. You know, and I kind of thought of it the same way, but it was kind of scary because I thought maybe I'll never write again. And then Michael, just one day, it was about 3 months, all of a sudden the pen took off again, and I wrote another stretch.
Can I ask you one thing?
Absolutely.
Were you, when you had that kind of block, were you trying to break through the block? Because what occurs to me is all of a sudden you're doing something, you could be drinking coffee, eating food, or doing something that has nothing to do with the project you're involved in.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden out of nowhere you get this,
yeah,
and you go, why didn't I think of that? So hurry up and get a pen and write it down before you forget it, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I think a lot of people do.
Yeah. And you know,
pull the car over, park, write it down so
yes. You and that's important to do, because if you try to remember it and then recreate it down, it doesn't come out the same way, does it?
Oh, no.
I learned that a lot. Even like when I was sleeping, sometimes I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I thought, oh, I'll just remember that in the morning. It never worked that way. So I learned at that point, I'd get up, write it down, And that helped. I don't think it might have been as good as if I actually got up and started writing it. You know, I just put down notes, but it, that helped. You know, and I think that the reason why I struggle with that is because as an athlete, I was trained to overcome all obstacles, never give in, never cave in, no matter what. It was just that there's no option. Second place or losing is not an option. And I think that in some ways actually was counterproductive as I look back on that. You know, I wanted to ask you, when you're writing music like that, is there an average length of how long your piece is, or does it vary? How does that work out for you?
It depends. If you're writing a regular song, like say like a commercial song, verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, verse, or whatever the pattern is. I'm not formally trained in I never was formally trained in writing. When I would write, it would just, if this sounds good with cellos with the French horns, like the early composers used it, because they blend good, use it. I'm sidetracking my thoughts, what I wanted to say.
That's okay.
Oh, the length, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, like in symphonies, they're expected the first movement, say we got 3 to 4 movements in a symphony, usually 4, I think. It's going to be maybe 10 to 12 minutes, maybe, then you go into slow movement. Yeah. So there's a certain expectation format of the European school. Commercial 15-second, 30-second TV jingle advertisement. You know, you got 15 seconds to 30 seconds. So sometimes they'll buy a minute block. So they know how to write how much length. But it depends on the style and what the composer, what format he's writing, who he's writing for, the length.
Yeah. Now, can you tell us what the real difference is?
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
That wasn't the answer.
No. Can you tell us, maybe you did, but can you tell us what the real difference is between your, you referred to European style of music. What is the difference between European, I assume, the American style?
Well, Americans, I think, I'll probably get criticized for this, but how do I answer this? And I think this, the classical world, we borrow a lot from the Europeans in writing style. My favorite would be Johannes Brahms. And you listen to his symphonies, like if you get a chance, listen to his third symphony all the way through, Johannes Brahms. We borrow certain techniques, like the concertmaster stands up, points to the oboe player for the A, whatever A is, and the orchestra tunes to it. That's European.
Okay.
Now there is a difference over in the States. The ends, remember there's two players per music stand.
Right.
The outside player plays the top line and what they call divided or divisi. The inside player will play the bottom line unless instructed not to. And the inside player's job, that would be my job in many cases, we turn the page for the outside player so he don't have to stop playing.
Okay.
I put it down, boom, turn, get back up and play again. That's European. What's different about Europe is I've heard, at least I've heard it through colleagues, that in Europe, the outside player, which is closest to the page, turns page, and the inside player keeps playing.
Oh, so just
a big difference. It's visually, you know, there's just certain customs. And when I say European school, that's what I mean. We take a lot of influence from Europe, and rightly so. I mean, we got, you know, from Vivaldi all the way up to the current.
Yeah.
And the good thing about American music, like Aaron Copland, really personified in the film composers, Elmer Bernstein, you know, bum, 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 Marlboro Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Very, very Western persona, but very United States groove. Copland kind of got a lot to that. And there's another guy that you'd love. He did all these, Bernard Herrmann, Sinbad the Sailor.
Yeah.
Seven Forms of Sinbad.
Yeah.
Psycho, he did Psycho. He did Journey to the Center of the Earth. I mean, that guy borrowed heavily from Europe, and he wrote in a European style, but for a film format. The guy is a monster.
Wow.
You'd love him.
I'm sure I would, because I love that. I love music like that. I mean, when I do my cardio, I'm always listening to music. And you know, something that's pretty interesting was what I learned, especially early on and as through my career, was how music and certain types of music impacted your workouts. And what was physiologically proven was that classical music was much more productive when you're training than hard rock. And it was simply because of the way the music sort of reacted with the way your heart rate or your heartbeat was. The hard rock was actually antagonistic to the to the workout because it was going opposite of what that beat was. Have you ever heard something like that?
Yeah, I also heard that just before you take an exam, to unpressurize it, to settle the nerves a little bit.
Yeah.
I can't prove this in theory, but I've heard it, you know, I've asked people about it and said, no, yeah, there's something to it. They've done research. If you play a little, you know, Mozart, it's certain classical stuff.
Yeah.
And as opposed to hearing some punk.
Yeah.
You hear that before you go in and take some math exam.
Yeah, interesting.
But if you hear some Chopin etudes on the piano or something mellow and kind of soft and, you know, non-grating on the ear,
right?
Somehow it works on the brain waves.
And yeah.
And the cardio, as well as the cardio.
Well, you know what I have noticed is this. If I'm driving in L.A., because I spent a lot of time down in L.A., Santa Monica, Venice area, because that's where the mecca of bodybuilding is there in Venice, Gold's Gym. Yeah. So I basically lived down there back in the 90s. And one of the things I did learn about is when I was traveling in traffic, I was a lot more stressed out when I heard rock and roll in traffic than I was if I listened to classical music, because I tested myself on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I really think that was legitimate.
There's something to it.
There is. There's something to it. Just like there's also something to it with regard to training, what colors that you wear or the colors that you're within, you know, blues and sort of those colors. Mm-hmm. It's a much calmer environment. And when you do, like, if you have, like, in your gym, yellows, bold yellows and reds and blacks, that has a tendency of actually improving training performance. But when it comes to the music, it's the classical. I find that stuff really, you know, it's a game of inches. You know, you want to win every little point that you can. So what do? You try to find different ways to beat your competition, or at least, you know, beat yourself each and every time you go perform.
Every little additive to the recipe pays off.
Yeah, that's what I think too.
And if colors, you know, like I think lavender is a beautiful color.
Yes, it is.
Kind of light pink, but not blatant pink.
There's
a kind of purplishness in it.
Yeah.
Looking color, you know.
Yeah. Another color that was really good was teal. And this is kind of what you're talking about, a little bit of teal. Those are good colors. In fact, they're great colors on TV. The camera just loves blues and teals and those kinds of things. It's interesting how
teal, things work. Leo, teal meaning half silver, half grayish, with a little blue in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Depending on the lighting, I guess.
Yeah, I had a lady one time. She was really big into colors at one of my studios. And she came in and she was into feng shui and all that kind of stuff, you know. So, periwinkle was the color that I ended up paying my painting my studio because of it was a calming effect. And of course, later on, I realized in the studies I read was that to produce a performance, you wanted really bold colors. So when you went into my gym, you got very calm.
Well, that's good. So you're relaxed. So, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know, going back to that, the two people in the stand that you call that. So it's almost a team sport, isn't it? Because you guys have to, you know, for it to all be pulled off, you got one person can't do it. So you guys got to play as a team, right?
Yeah. Well, you've been to an orchestra. You've seen them. You see all the bows go up and all the bows go down.
Yeah.
In the whole violin section. Now, sometimes in the cellos, they're going up when we're going down. So it depends on who's got what phrase.
Yeah.
There's a guy named Shostakovich, Stokowski, forgive me for my brain. Stokowski, I think it was he was one that had that movie Fantasia with Mickey Mouse with it.
Yeah.
The wand and all that. I forget what orchestra it was. Could have been Philadelphia. He said, no, free bowing, just phrase together. Here's a phrase. Da 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 da. That's one phrase.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of going da 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 da, he says, just everyone bow the way you want. Some guys are going, all in one bow. Some, in other words, all the bows are going like that. So it's not visually, it looks like chaos on stage.
Yeah.
It still sounds right because all the players know what's expected, how to phrase.
Right. Let me ask you this. Do you think that when you're more doing the more chaotic, when everybody's doing their own thing and the music is great, do you think that because it is chaotic, so optics wise and visually and aesthetics, do you think that when it's chaotic that the person that is watching it is paying attention more to the chaos than the actual music?
That's a great point. Yeah, because people are so used to like uniformity. You know, everyone's got to harmonize and just everyone's got the same uniform, you know, little penguins and this.
Yeah.
I think it does. It could, you know.
I would think that. I mean, you know, like on, I've done a lot of TV commercials and things like that. And I've been on live TV. And one of the things I learned, because when I get into something, like Michael, I'm sure you're like this. I like to learn stuff to the, I call it to the nth degree, to the minute degree. I like to know all the little nuances and anything that'll make me better on camera in this case. One of the things that was talked about is they said, look, be careful how you wear your hair. If you're wearing your hair spiked up and you've got a wild shirt on, well, people are going to pay more attention to that than they are as to what you're saying. So that's what made me think of this, the chaos, if it distracted the individual from actually the beautiful music that was going on, you know?
I don't think that Freeborn caught on too well because there's a lot of traditionalists in the classical realm. And they say, well, yeah, it's a little too out there. You know,
was that something European or something more American?
You know, I wish I could answer that. I'm not qualified. It could have come from Europe. I know Stokowski, I think he was European. So there's a good bet somewhere in Europe it was done before.
Yeah.
You know, that's a raw guess. So.
Yeah. Going back to when we're talking about holding the violin up here, when you're first learning and playing the violin, being in that position, does your shoulder and body start burning in the beginning? And does your body, obviously your body adapts to that, but do you have to like build up a tolerance to hold that? How much does a violin weigh, first of all?
Oh my God, I think I never thought about that all these
years. I guess I think it's stupid stuff.
What's wrong with me? I'd say they're light.
Yeah, I would think so.
They're light because they're hollow inside except for sound posts.
Yeah, but still, if you're holding just a light thing like that for, you know, hours, it's going to hurt.
You see, a couple of pounds, I'm probably way up. I got to find that out.
Yeah.
That's going to be my mission today.
Okay. And then when you're holding, I assume that are there different ways that one can hold it into their shoulder? Do some people have it a certain way and other people's another way?
That's a great point. Me personally, I don't want to use the term most, but a lot of players have what they call a shoulder pad.
Okay.
Like I had a short neck. I would need a thin pad. It helps secure the violin. So, cause you want this hand free to move up and down totally free, you know? Okay. And if you're holding up the instrument and trying to finger at the same time, you know, no dice.
Right.
And people, usually young ladies or old ladies or middle-aged ladies in general, some of them have long aristocratic necks, real long necks.
Yeah.
They need the shoulder pad. Now, there's an old school in the old days, they didn't have shoulder pads. They were just, they had to bear down with their chin, and you get this part of your clavicle here.
Yeah.
And it's very uncomfortable at first. When you first learn the violin, Leo, it's like, dang, man. It's easier to watch someone play than actually try and play. But by the third, fourth week, you get used to it. And then the big problem is having the thumb come under the neck. If I had the violin here, I could demonstrate, but I don't have it. So there's... You're bringing up some good mechanical points.
That would seem like your forearm would start burning like hell after a while.
If it goes too far this way, you're going to feel it right here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. That's your way up on the fingerboard.
Hey, you know, I wonder if the
height. I'm sorry.
Tell me if this is the case. I'm referring back to now weight training. You know, we have like when we're doing a squat, we have a bar that we put on our back to do a squat.
I've seen it.
Okay. Now, I'm old school, and they also have these little, we call them sissy pads, that you can wrap that bar and then put it on your back. And the people that are old school are saying, don't ever put a pad on that bar.
You put the bar on your back and you let your body adapt to that environment and stop being a sissy.
Really?
Yeah. But so I'm wondering, do those guys in the old days when they didn't have a pad and when they saw guys come up and they put these little pads on their violins, did they scoff at them and they say, come on, man?
Yeah. No? No, it's because they probably had one themselves. No, the pad just it's a bridge. It secures the violin.
Yeah.
Helps so you don't have to bear down
on sure.
it so hard.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't think they diss it out too much. They okay. may laugh and giggle at it, you know, but
yeah.
I caught you the other night wearing one. What are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's funny. You know, that kind of reminds me, that's kind of like a, to me, it's kind of like a fit that you get that's just right so you're not uncomfortable. And one of the things I got into during my weight training days, I took off 13 years from my sport. I had enough. I did it so much and I competed so much. I just took a break and it ended up being 13 years. I got into bicycle riding, long distance. And one of the things I learned about that is that you have to be fit on your bike when you're doing 200 and 300 mile rides. If you're not fit perfectly, that thing tears you up. And I think that you're talking about the same thing. If you're just not fit quite right with your violin and yeah. you're tweaked, I mean, I could see where that could be very uncomfortable.
It'll interfere with intonation. You know, I was told the Catholic nun, my dear friend up in Spokane, she says, you know, get that thumb under. And she says, there's going to, later in life, it's going to haunt you. It's going to come back. And sure enough, there's times when I'm painting. We get up on the G string, which is the lowest string, which is on the left side. Yeah. And you got to get over. And I'm, you know, I've played certain violins that are easy. It's a whiz, man. But my own regular violin from Tyrolia, I have to kind of muscle it. And I got to really be careful about it. But is it in tune or out of tune?
Yeah.
You know, because you know, my hand position was, a lot of guys that they practice. I didn't, here's confession time. I didn't do enough practicing on the G string on the violin to really get comfortable. Like you playing the D, A, or E string, I don't got a problem.
Yeah, that's at the other end, right? The
E. Yeah, it's E is the top right, A is next to it, then D.
Yeah.
Get lowered down to the G. There yeah. it is. But yeah, it's a, and there's another thing. My first finger sticks up when I play a lot of fast notes, and a lot of in the schooling is keep the first finger down as long as it doesn't interfere with the scale. I just blew it up and didn't care.
Yeah,
but it's not the best technique.
Let's take a quick pause to tell you about something you are definitely going to want.
Do you want a bone-crushing grip? Good, because you're gonna get one with the amazing new TRS Gripper. It's a progressive grip builder with longer handles and a special ergonomic design that's like a dozen hand grippers in one. Start off easy and work your way up to quickly build your grip strength from wet noodle to pulverizing. The package includes a video from the world-famous strength coach, Dr. Russ Horine, the man who worked with Leo Costa to help bring you big beyond belief in the Bulgarian Power Burst. Dr. Horine shows you a simple and easy to follow workout plan that takes just minutes a day right from in front of your TV set if you want. So click on the link below and let's get started building you a stronger, firmer, bone-crushing grip.
Yeah. Well, you know something, Michael, tell me if this happens in your arena with violin playing. I'm going to give you an example of a baseball player. There is and this actually happened, you know, I learned this with my kids because I got very involved in mechanics and all that kind of stuff because I was an athlete myself, as I told you.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the scouts told me one time, they said, you know, some of these coaches that are coaching these kids, they make them too robotic. They want their hands at a certain place. Your feet spacing like this, and you take this step. And they said, what ends up happening when you train everybody the same way, this was their words, you take the genius out of the natural athlete who doesn't, you would think that they shouldn't be able to hit a ball because of what they do with their hands, and yet they're a great hitter in this case. Would that be similar, like playing a violin? Because I'm assuming that there's a certain way that they teach you. But then you have to make it your own, right?
Yes. Yeah. I know what you mean about that roboticism. It may look uniform, but everyone's configured differently, physically, mentally. Some people have long arms, long hands, long fingers. Some people are like me, short hands, squared hands, which is, you know, piano players, like, it's better to have longer fingers, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, there has to be some, the player's got to be comfortable. The athlete's got to be comfortable. He can still discipline certain parameters.
Yeah.
But it's got to be, he's got to know, I got a little freedom to, like, if I want to boogie a little bit.
Yeah.
Where that fastball comes in.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, because what you looked like with the hitters, what you did end up finding out was that they were in the right spot when they needed to be. It's just all this stuff that they did before, you know, but when it actually came for the bat hitting the ball, they were in perfect, just exactly where they needed to be mechanically to be a great hitter. And I think that would be the same thing with what you're doing.
Last night I was watching The Natural with Robert Redford, and where he plays that, Rory Hobbs.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that film.
He made his own bat.
Yeah.
And they had that scene. I don't know if that was based on fiction or if it is actual historical, if he actually existed. But there's one scene in the movie where he's hitting homers just consistently.
Yeah.
All you'd hear is the sound effect of the wood on the ball, you know. But
yeah.
It got what you're saying, explaining to me, got me thinking about that scene in that movie. I can see where coaches want us, you know, maybe they're trying to instill a certain discipline of stance for the player.
Yeah.
They got to feel, you know, free. Like, look at the catcher. He's down there. He's doing, you know, finger signs and things, you know. Yeah. I don't know. Did you find that happening in your life? Did you have coaches that?
Oh, yeah.
If you try and mold a candidate in a certain area, there's a cutoff point. There's got to be a little room, wiggle room, or whatever they call it.
And this is where great coaches don't get enough. They don't get enough respect in some cases, because they know how to let the athlete become, reach their full athletic potential. Yeah. And then you got some coaches that it's kind of like a boss that micromanages somebody.
Oh yeah.
I see it kind of in the same way. And that's why I was wondering, you know, you can teach how to hold that, you know, you're supposed to kind of hold that violin, and this is the way you should do. But I think there's certain people just have a certain way that gets their groove on, and maybe it doesn't look necessarily textbook, but what comes out of that damn athlete or that violinist, that's all that really matters, really.
That's what matters.
You know?
And through the years, they develop some kind of, you know, tick or something, you know. I mean, that's part of aging. Affects something.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's got to be a little bit of freedom for the player to, you know.
I think that's well said, that what you're saying, that freedom. You got to give them a little wiggle room, you know, to do make their magic.
And if they know they got their hand position looks like terrible, you know, then that's on them. But as long as they nail the passage.
Right.
Who really is going to lose sleep over it?
Yeah, seriously. Because that's not, you know, the stated goal in this case is to make great music. And if that's how you have to do to make great music, of course, the other argument would be, well, maybe if you tweaked it like that, you can make even greater music. You know, there's that argument always, I guess.
Yeah. It might change things. And it's hard for a musician over the years to just switch styles.
Yeah.
Styles, that's the wrong word. Switch anatomical positioning.
Yeah.
Strongly advised by a very good teacher.
Right.
There's no other way to do it. You got to just eat it. They do it.
Yeah, and you're right. You know, but one of the things about great athletes, and I just think so many things just transfer over in different areas, like what we're talking about, athletics and playing a violin. And what I've learned with the great ones is they have the ability through their career, and I think this is what you're saying, to reinvent themselves. Because as you age, things change, you know, and basically what that does for the athlete, it keeps them relevant. It keeps them still in the ball game, still playing at that high level. And I think that's also very important, because you do change. Everything's in flux.
Yeah. What I admire a lot about athletes, superstar athletes, is, you know, like fighter pilots get trained on eyesight as a critical thing. if you ever notice, they talked about Bengal tigers. If you get on eye level with them, they can't see you coming as long as you're right at their eyesight. But if you go off at a certain angle, then they can track you real easy. That's why when you see a jet coming, you don't realize it's coming. All of a sudden, where'd you come from?
Yeah.
Because the eye can't discern the closure.
I'll be darned.
What gets me about athletes is how the heck they can, you know, some of these balls are coming at 90 plus miles an hour. And still, I wonder if it's half feeling. I get a gut about this ball. So is sinker, you know, no.
Yeah.
They hit it. You know, or by accident. But the eyesight is, that's, I mean, that's a gift. I think that's also a developed gift.
Yeah.
I mean, all you do is to hit balls your whole life. You get good at it.
Yeah. You know, in our sport, it's repetition is the mother of skill. And, you know, and it's practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect practice makes perfect. And so you get to the point where, you know, the scouts used to say, you know, when those great athletes are in the batter's box, the great ones are so relaxed, they're almost asleep. But the minute that ball leaves the hand of that pitcher, it's all game on, you know. And one of the most difficult things, as you know, is to hit a round ball with a round bat that's going 95 miles an hour and moving all kinds of direction. And hitting that thing squarely. Yeah. And so that's why in that sport, if you're hitting 300, you're successful. What other kind of industry can you be in and you know, 30% basically being successful? It's not. No,
that's athletic virtuosity.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a high level skill.
Oh,
and some people say, well, maybe it's part luck. Maybe it's not luck. Maybe it's skill.
Yeah.
You know? But
you've heard of this saying, I'd rather be lucky sometimes than good. I think that comes into play sometimes. You got to be lucky too. You know, sometimes when a batter is in a slump, they just can't buy a hit, you know? And then all of a sudden they hit this little blooper, you know, and it turns them into a hitting streak that they go on. So anyway, I want to talk about and kind of finish up here with, and I did it on purpose. I see that you've played with so many famous people. And I wonder if there's, I guess I have a couple of questions, but how in the world did you connect with some of these people? And I assume that it was just being in the industry and being around in the round environment, and then you were damn good. Am I close?
Yeah, it's people, you know, refer you. It just really comes down to your fellow guy, friends that they recommend you. It's pretty much simple.
Who was your first, like, would you say, big name that you played with, and how intimidated were you?
Up at Harrah's Casino Showroom, Stateline, Nevada, in South Lake Tahoe, as Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, man.
And I was scared. All the cats in the band room, man, they partied with him. He comes and parties with the guys, man.
Is that right?
And he makes you feel right at home. He's a gentleman. No one else is nervous. Why am I doing this with my hands? And
yeah.
So you go on stage, then you're focused on the notes. You don't think about, well, I'm not nervous now because I feel natural because I'm playing.
Sure.
But you get off stage, you go back. It took me a couple shows before I could. And he was just wonderful to the
I just watched something on Netflix on the Rat Pack, and they were talking about Sammy Davis Jr. And, you know, amazing that you got to play with somebody like that. Who else did you really enjoy, or what that was maybe a very unique experience that you played with?
In that vein, in the showroom vein?
Whatever vein. I mean, I'm just really curious because you have so many people that you've been around and played with. I'm just really curious as how some of those relationships, you know, how they began and how unique maybe one or two that stands out to you besides Sammy Davis Jr.
Yeah, I did a 2-month tour with Eric Clapton. It was we were 1 month on the road, then a week off, then another month. It was the Unplugged 98 tour.
Oh, really?
The American tour was Unplugged. And he did he did like an acoustic set, then an electric set.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. Another guy, just a total gentleman to everyone. You know?
Yeah. You know, so many of those real pros are real gentlemen. You know, it's the guys that are kind of like coming up sometimes that are the idiots. You know, but some of those guys that they're true professionals, they're good guys and good women, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I've noticed too.
It doesn't mean they haven't paid their dues and they haven't had the same feelings that you and I have. They're at a level of where there's so many people that come to see them.
Yeah.
That's like when you do exhibitions. I mean, did you ever feel nervous in front of
I would be nervous. It was that game time, pre-game nervousness. I always was nervous. In fact, I use that as sort of a measuring, kind of a guide. If I wasn't nervous, I was kind of worried about that. When I was nervous, the game jitters, because the minute I played a lot of football, the minute I got hit, or the minute, the minute the game started, is like you said it at the beginning in the show, you relaxed once you started playing the show. It was afterwards when you were with Sammy Davis Jr. that you were nervous. But yes, I got nervous every single time, and I still do. When I do talks or anything like that, to me, I just go back to this is like when I was playing sports. Now it's game time, you know? What I found that really helps, and I'm sure that you feel the same way, is when I feel that I put my time in and my practice, that I wasn't, I couldn't do anymore. I did everything that I could. Yeah. It was just, you got to just let it go and let the chips fall where they may. I always felt better about that than if I wasn't quite, because I came into a couple of shows that I should have probably dieted in an extra 2 weeks to come into bodybuilding shows, and I knew I wasn't quite on. And that affected my performance. No doubt.
Yeah.
When you were on tour with Clapton, I mean, were you just in heaven for that month?
It was, I loved it. I got to know some of the gals who came from New York. It was mostly Hollywood area, LA area. One or two from San Francisco and about five people from New York. So we're all string players. So we're in a like fellowship.
Yeah.
All, even though we don't know each other, but that changed. Everyone got along famously.
Yeah.
And he flew us everywhere. None of this bus crap.
Oh, man.
But I mean, take a bus to get to the venue, but from there. But that's the only way to do it.
Oh, hell yeah.
By air.
Oh, yeah.
I mean.
Especially when you're flying private. Did you guys fly private or commercial?
Commercial.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I used to train.
He took care of us. He was wonderful. And at the LAX, I'm coming out with my bag. And he's right across the little carousel thing. So he reaches over and he lunges with his arm out. And he's, hey, God bless you, Eric. He just puts his arm out like that. No, he's very congenial.
It's nice when you have that kind of a experience with somebody that
nervous comes around. As Elvis Presley walks by, oh, the king's
coming. Yeah.
I'd feel intimidated if the king.
Yeah.
King walking by.
Did you ever have to?
Everybody does, man. I just.
Yeah. So, okay. So, did you ever have to? This is something that is this a come with your where you were with these people? Did you like sign autographs, or were you guys pretty well known, or are you more background?
We're section. They had us kind of elevated up. Here's Eric in front. The drummer's right behind him.
Yeah.
And the guitar and the bass, they're all pretty much on the stage. Then they had these rafters, because there's 20 string players.
Okay.
Because they had two cellos, one string bass, one viola, and the rest of violins. So it was a lot of string players up on, and we're sitting there, we're wearing black, so we don't shine into the lights.
Yeah. You're kind of like the referee that you want to know they're there, but you don't want them to stand out and be distracting.
We don't want to distract from the headliner.
Yes, it makes sense to me.
Wayne Newton used to, when we played Wayne, he would do stuff like, he would solo people out of the band and talk about nerves. These little lasers coming down.
Would it be just impromptu, or did you know it was going to happen?
We didn't know. We knew it was going to happen, but we didn't know who it was going to happen to.
So all be ready.
And so Wayne would do something like, yada, told me this joke about this and this and this and this. And Ralfredo, the percussion player who's with his regular band, with Wayne's band, he says, who told you that, Wayne? And he would say, that fiddle player's sitting right next to you.
Oh, man,
talk about it. And then the spotlight from the lighting.
Yeah, it's on you.
Oh, and so he sit there poised like a mummy. You kind of grimace with a smile.
Oh, you dirty rat, you.
Please ignore me.
Yeah, yeah.
That was probably just emitting even more energy where he knew exactly who to point to. That guy over there was really nervous. I can tell by his nonverbal.
Yeah. Everyone got a kick out of it. So, and then everyone relaxed afterwards.
Yeah.
So he made it fun.
Yeah. Well, listen, Michael, this has been a lovely, at least for me, I don't know about for you, it's been a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed learning. I learned a lot of stuff from talking to you. This is one of the great things I like about doing my podcast is I bring people in from different walks of life. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing, you know, you've heard of this before, 6 degrees of separation. It's amazing how many things are actually sort of similar, and yet we come from different worlds. And I find that to be interesting for me.
Yeah.
You know, to get into somebody else's head and learn stuff. And you've certainly done that.
I learned quite a bit about the athletic do's and don'ts. And I'm still got this picture in my head about that barbell.
Yeah.
You know, forget the pad.
Take that. We can just call it a vagina pad. Take that vagina pad off. Be a man. You know, throw those things. Bravado.
Get scab on my.
Yeah, that's what we want to see. Blood running down your back, you sissy. Don't put that pad on your vinyl lid. Come on, man. Let's go. Get with it. Anyway, hey, listen. I really enjoyed you coming out. I appreciate your time. I really do.
My pleasure.
And do me a favor, if you would. And I'm very serious about this. If you, I want to go to a concert of some kind, even if it's really small, with violins playing. If you ever know of somebody doing it in the LA area or San Francisco, because I'm in the middle of the state. I'm in Central California. Yeah. I'd love to come watch that. If it's you, anything, I want to come hear you or some people play violins.
Okay.
All right?
I can get a hold of Kara, or I can have Rick Bemis, my dear friend. He can get a hold of you.
Perfect. Kara. That would be great.
If there's any chamber ensemble, so we'll keep an ear out.
Yeah, please do. I'm real serious about that. I really love stuff like that.
The more the public sees live performance, let's get back to normal.
That's right. You better believe it. I'm sick of the new normal. That doesn't sit real well with me. But anyway, I feel like you're my friend. Thank you for coming on. And hopefully we talk again. And I can see you again someday playing your violin.
I would look forward to it.
Okay, sir.
Okay.
You have a good day. Stay safe.
You too. Thank
bye,
you.
Bye, Michael.
Thanks bye. For listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.